Coming from the backwoods of New Jersey, welcome to the Jersey Guys Music Podcast, where we feature in-depth music discussions and interviews with special guests from the worlds of hard rock, heavy metal, and AOR music. So settle in and crank it up. Now, here are your hosts, the Jersey Guys themselves, Tom and Mark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Jersey Guys podcast. I'm Mark Ballow here with my co-host, Tom Coyne. Today, we've got a special guest. This guy has been in the music industry for over 40 years. He's played with some really iconic artists. But we're going to talk to him about a lot of the stuff that he's done in his career. We're talking about bands like Rainbow, Cyndi Lauper, Enrique Iglesias, and Billy Joel. So we've got a lot of good stuff to talk about. So please welcome to the show, keyboard player, composer, producer, songwriter, musical director, and Berklee College of Music graduate, David Rosenthal. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks, guys. Good to see you both. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for taking some time to talk to us. I had to do that long intro. I'm like, you've done so much stuff in your career. we could really talk to you for hours, like we said a few minutes ago, but we want to compact it and get it, you know, nice and keep it good there. So I guess we're going to start with obviously the band Rainbow. You entered the band at 20 years old. I know Tom's got some really good stuff we're going to start with, so I guess we'll kick it off with that.
Sure.
Well, I guess my first question is how you got the gig, and once you did get the gig, was Ritchie Blackmore everything you had heard about?
Okay, so I'll start with how I got the gig. So I was just finishing up at Berklee, and a friend of mine knew a friend of Richie's that, and that's how I found out that he was looking for a keyboard player. And so I sent him a cassette tape, showing my age here, of my, it was my senior recital at Berklee, which was all classical because I knew that he liked classical music. And then on one side of the tape, and the other side of the tape was my cover band that I had at the time. And we were playing all stuff like Kansas, Boston, Foreigner, stuff that was popular, you know, in that time period. This is 1981. And he really liked the tape. So he invited me down to audition. I was still living in Boston. Cause I was, as I said, I was just finishing up Berklee. And, So I brought my keyboard setup down there, which I didn't have much. I was a broke musician. I had a Farfisa and a Rhodes and a Roland synthesizer. But I brought it with me because that was my gear. And I went down. It was a cattle call audition. There's all these keyboard players around. And I get there. And the audition, he says, Roger Glover was running the auditions. He's a bass player and also from Deep Purple. And he says, well, you don't need your gear. We have a keyboard set up here for you to play. So I said, okay. So they had a Hammond and a mini Moog and a clavinet and all these keyboards that I had learned about, but I'd never had any hands-on experience with it. We jammed for a little bit and played some songs, went through some Rainbow stuff. And then I got a call back and it was down to me and one other guy. And they said, so tomorrow you're going to come back and we'll give, you know, the afternoon will be 3 hours for the other guy, and then you'll have 3 hours in the evening, and so we can really make a final decision. So I was like, okay, cool. So now I go back, and then I figure, all right, how can I get an edge on this guy? What can I do to beat him out? So the next morning I wake up, and I call every Sam Ash on Long Island to find out who has these keyboards on display, a mini Moog and things like that. And I found a place, and I explained to the salesman what I was doing. And he said, hey, knock yourself out. Here's a set of headphones. So I went and I noodled around with the mini Moog all afternoon and played on some of the other stuff. And I got a bunch of sounds. So I went back that was for my callback doing being more familiar with the keyboards than I was even the day before. And then what I found out a year later, obviously I got the gig, but I found out a couple interesting things later, about a year later, excuse me. One of the things that really tipped it over the edge, obviously, you know, I can play, but they, you know, and I clicked with Richie right away musically. We just clicked. And but at one point during the audition, Roger Glover came up to me and he said, Okay, so now we're on stage in front of 20,000 people and Richie just broke a string and you have to fill space, go. Okay, so I just, you know, I played something on the Hammond, something really, rock and, sort of John Lordy on the Hammond. And I did a few riffs on the Mini Moog and I played something on the clavinet. Anyway, I didn't think anything of it. He just said, play something. So I played. But he later told me, Roger told me that he said, out of all the people that they asked that question, he said, I was the only guy who actually just started playing. And he said, everybody else had an excuse. Oh, don't worry about me. I'll prepare something. I'll be ready for that. Oh, you don't have to worry about me. I'll come up with something or what. Everybody had an excuse, and they really just wanted to know that I was fearless. But it was interesting that was one of the things that put it over the edge. And I also found out later that Richie's manager at the time, Bruce Payne, thought I was too young at 20 years old to join the band. And Richie said, I don't care. He's my guy. He's really good. I want him in the band. And they had a big argument about it, which fortunately Richie won the argument and I ended up in the band.
Yeah. So it showed an ability of you being able to stand on your feet and think, it should have an emergency showed up like that.
Exactly. I guess. Yeah. I mean, I didn't think much of it at the time. He asked me to play. So I played, I didn't think anything of it, but looking back on it, I can see how that might have made a difference to them in terms of, just knowing that I'm going to be able to hold my own at 20 years old.
Yeah.
Now, you were following a long list of keyboard legends, Tony Carey, David mm-hmm. Stone, who was mm-hmm. monumentally talented, Don mm-hmm. Airey. Mm-hmm. Was there any pressure brought on you by that to try to fill shoes, or was Blackmore like, do your own thing?
He was like, it was do your own thing, but that didn't really come about until we were in the studio. That didn't all happen in the audition.
Right.
But because there were so many great keyboard players prior to me, I think three or four, as you just named, what I did before I went to the audition was I listened really carefully to all of the Rainbow records. And I thought, whatever these four keyboard players have in common, that's what Richie likes in a keyboardist. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to, mold my style accordingly for the audition. And I think some of that homework that I put into just, really learning about what Rainbow was about, who Richie was, what he liked, those types of things, helped me get the audition at the end of the day.
In fact, I think Don Airey probably would have stayed if not for, I think he jettisoned over to Ozzy at that point.
I think that came later. I think there was a little bit of a rub with him and Richie.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. See, that was just my own surmise.
I think he went to Ozzy a little bit after that, but I'm not 100% sure the exact timing of when he went over there, but nonetheless, he left at the end of the Difficult to Cure tour.
Yeah. Right. I think I read the old Musical Differences thing at one point somewhere.
Interesting.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Musical difference. Yeah. Whatever. I wasn't there. So I can't really comment. I've met Don. He's a great guy and a fantastic keyboard player.
Now this version of Rainbow you were coming into was a somewhat different animal from the Dio and even the Graham Bonnet period. It was kind of moving more in a bit of a USA commercial direction. Would that be fair to say?
I think so. I think a lot of that was the addition of Jolin Turner in the band. He's a great singer and had just a very American sounding voice. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a big part of it. And also he was a big part of the writing too. But really that started on Difficult to Cure, the album before Scrape Between the Eyes. And that's when that, new style came into being, or that little bit of a turn with the style of Rainbow, I think started then. And then the Straight Between the Eyes album, which was my first album, was really the same lineup as Difficult to Cure, except for me.
Right. Okay. Now on that album, I consider it like a top two or three Rainbow album. I thought it's out of the three albums he did post, the old sounding Rainbow. I thought it was the best of the three. If you could tell us a little bit about the recording process of that and the songwriting and how that whole album came together. There's just some legendary songs on it.
Yeah, the album came out great. I mean, I didn't really know what to expect. I just went. I'm just like, okay, let's go. So I got the gig, and a few weeks later, we went up to Vermont, and they rented a big giant house where we were all staying in the house, and we set up in the living room, and we just started jamming. And most of the songs, I'd say pretty much all the songs, start with some riff or some idea that Richie has, and Joe kind of, you know, scats along with it. We just kind of jam on it. And then, you know, we kept on doing little pieces of stuff, but nothing was finished. And Richie really likes to write largely in the studio, but he doesn't want to go in to the studio from square one. So, you know, basically, I don't think we had any finished songs, but we had a bunch of really solid riffs and some really good sections of songs. Like the basic idea of the songs was kind of in place, but they weren't really written yet. And that happened in the studio after we went up and did that, because he really likes to work up the song. And as soon as it becomes into existence, while it's super, super fresh and everybody's just getting comfortable playing with it, record it at that moment. And then Joe would, you know, at that time, even at that point in time, Joe may not have had all the lyrics. He might have had a couple of phrases here or there, but he had kind of a sketch of the melodies and would be scatting a little bit. And then he would refine the lyrics and then eventually, you know, record the vocals.
Now, how did you fit in with this band? Now, you have there's some legends involved in this band now, and you're a 21-year-old guy. How did you fit in with them? Was it difficult, or?
I didn't really think about that. I was too young to have any thoughts like that, to be honest. I was just kind of going along with it, you know? But obviously we all musically clicked. I mean, you can hear that in the Eyes album. And, you know, I just did what I thought would sound good. And Richie liked what I brought to the table. And when the album was released, the world seemed to like it as well. And so I just, you know, I just do what I think would sound good. And I liked his riffs. I loved the songs that he came up with, and Joe came up with some great melodies. And I co-wrote on that album one of the songs. And it was really just just a great experience. Everything was brand new for me. I'm not the kind of guy that gets starstruck, so I wasn't like that in front of Richie or Roger, who had the biggest names in the band. Mm-hmm. I just got along with him great, and even I got along with Richie with no problem. He and I had a mutual musical respect for each other right out of the box, and I never really had any problems with him. I know a lot of other people did,
right?
But I didn't.
Yeah. Well, you had a little bit of a Jersey connection with Joe, both being Jersey guys. Sure. You being from Edison, Joe being from up Hackensack area or something like that. Right. But yeah, so that was probably a nice little thing to have a couple Jersey guys there.
Of course, yeah. I mean, I hadn't known Joe prior to that, but yeah, of course, I know that he was from New Jersey.
And Ron Dinelli was a local guy too. He was from Long Island. Yeah.
And then later on the Bent Out of Shape album, when Chuck Berge played, right, he's from New Jersey as well. So,
yeah.
Now, were you the subject of any of Richie's legendary pranks?
So, nobody escapes joining Rainbow without some new guy treatment,
right.
There was some of that, most of it was kind of funny, to be honest. One of my favorite memories was, we recorded the album after we finished in Vermont. We went up to, Morin Heights in Canada and recorded at Les Studio, this beautiful studio that was I don't know if it was a converted house or it was built from the ground up to be that, but it's in the middle of the woods. And then about a quarter mile through the woods on the other side of this lake is this huge house where we all stayed. And it was late fall and into the winter even. And it was tons of snow and everything was cold, just gorgeous. I mean, and at the studio, they had floor to ceiling windows in the live room with a view of the frozen lake and the trees and the snow. It's just spectacularly gorgeous. I mean, a lot of bands recorded up there. Rush did a lot of stuff.
I was going to say Rush had that video, right, where you could see in the background.
And you could see that in the background. So that's exactly the view when you're recording. And plus, we're all sort of like sequestered there. And so it was really cool. Anyway, so each of us had our own little, bedroom and bathroom within this big house. And then they had a chef making meals for us and whatnot. It was pretty cool. So I was doing my keyboard overdubs one night and it was really late. I was on a roll and I just kept going. And, you know, I finished at like 2 a.m, something like that. And I did the walk. I walked back through the woods. I was there by myself, just with the engineer. everybody else had gone back to the house already. And I get back and I walk into my room and there's absolutely nothing in the room. No furniture, no bed, no nothing. It's like the room is just completely empty. And I'm like, okay, what's going on here? And then I look out and there out in the snow is my whole room perfectly set up, like the room with the bed made and everything, but out in the snow.
I read about this in a book. I was hoping you were going to tell that. I was leading you on with this.
Yeah. So, that's pretty funny. So then, you know, they were waiting up and they got tired of waiting up for me because it ended up being so late and they were all kind of getting ready to go to bed. And then they came to see my expression and whatever, when they saw that I was coming. And then Richie woke up the crew and made them go out and bring all the stuff back in. Of course, it had been out there probably 5-6 hours or so. There was no way I could sleep in that bed.
It was a nice cube. Yeah.
So I had to sleep on the floor that night.
So now the album is done and now you're going to go on your first major tour with a huge rock band. What was that experience like for you?
Again, it was, you know, everything was brand new. It was a lot of fun. It was really a lot of fun. We did one warm-up gig in Illinois. Don't remember exactly where, but it was a smaller place, like a 5,000-seat shed, just to kind of, you know, just a warm-up gig, basically. And then we went right to playing arenas. And, you know, I played the songs and I learned all the old stuff that I needed to learn, which there's so many great songs in the back catalog at that point. And then of course the stuff on the Straight Between the Eyes album, which I knew all of them because I recorded them. So, it did really well. And, Stone Cold was released. And it was right in the early days of MTV. And MTV got really behind it. They played the hell out of our video, which was amazing. It kept on coming on and on and on all the time. And then we actually, it was a really good tour. We had some really interesting openers. We had the Scorpions opened for us. That was my first chance of playing Madison Square Garden, which was in 1982, my first time. Of course, not knowing that I would go on to play another 131 times there, which is surreal. I can't even imagine those words come out of my mouth. Yeah. But that was my first time playing Madison Square Garden. And the Scorpions, of course, went on to become much bigger than Rainbow, but they were opening for us at that point. Iron Maiden was opening. They were the second opener. They were traveling in station wagons at that time. They were just coming up. 38 Special opened up for us. And it was a lot of fun. And we did a whole world tour. It was a chance. I spent almost, at age 21, I was on the road almost that whole year.
Wow.
So it was very cool.
Now we move to the next album, Bent Out of Shape, which to me was even more commercial than its predecessor.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
Was that, and I'm assuming this, but was that to really capitalize on the MTV and the commercial end of hard rock?
Yeah. I mean, it may be in hindsight, but I don't think it was a calculated move.
Okay.
These are just the songs that were coming out of Richie and Joe at the time. And obviously Joe's influence in the songwriting was prominent. And, this is, there was a big movement in that direction, but I don't think that Richie was ever a guy that tried to be this or tried to be that. He does what he does. But I think Joe's influence in the songwriting and the fact that we had, with the exception of Richie and Roger, the rest of the band was American. And I think that all, brought more of an American flavor to it than the earlier, Rainbow albums had.
Because I had read in one of the many Deep Purple books I have that Blackmore used to be known for saying that until he got his songs on a jukebox and could walk into, like a bar or something like that, he didn't feel like an inner success with his music. And with the as great as the Dio Rainbow was and Purple was, he wanted to have that commercials. Like he felt like he never arrived until he got commercial set, music on the radio, which he got with these two albums.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, right. Yeah. I've never heard that quote from him before, but it doesn't surprise me. I mean, it was something that, Rainbow didn't get a lot of airplay in the early years. The songs were great. The albums were great, but it wasn't very commercial,
They really never broke the US market. The Dio Rainbow,
Right. I mean, well, not the Dio Rainbow, but since you've been gone with Graham.
Yes, the Bonnet stuff started too, but the Dio, Dio, for some reason, never broke the U.S. market at all. They come over here, they would play small theaters, and then, you know, they do massive over in Europe and Japan.
Well, I think, you know, Ronnie James Dio was what an incredible discovery of, you know, that had there. And I think he's one of the greatest heavy metal singers of all time. And he was really a pioneer of that style of singing, but he was a little ahead of the curve, I think, in those days.
Now, how was the tour for the, now you're going to, going on another world tour? How was
it? Well, we did the Bent Out of Shape album. That one we did in Copenhagen at Sweet Silence Studios. And again, we did the same thing. We started the same way. We rented a big house in Vermont and jammed out all the ideas. And then we went over to Copenhagen to record the album. And then Chuck Berge came in and did all the drums. And he and I have a long history of playing now.
I was going to say that you, I don't know who followed who. I mean, obviously he followed you into Rainbow, but you go on to Red Dawn. He's in the band. You go on to Enrique Iglesias tour. He's in the band. Billy Joel, he's in the band. You guys are together. Yeah.
Well, we didn't script it, but it just all kind of happened that way. And, we're great friends. I mean, I obviously Red Dawn was my band, and you know, when I was putting that band together, who's the best drummer I've ever worked with? And Chuck Berge. So, but I didn't really think he would want to do it. But I told him about it, and he said, "Yeah." He goes, "Let me get together." And then Greg Smith, who I hadn't met prior to that, but somebody had referred. Oh, no, that's not true. I played with him at a NAMM show with Joe Franco. That's how I met Greg Smith. And I was like, this guy's really good. But then the first time I heard Greg and Chuck play together, the first time they ever met each other and played together was at a Red Dawn audition. And literally from the first downbeat, those guys, they just feel time that like without even thinking, they just play together. And I heard that and I was like, there's my rhythm section right there. Okay. And so, yeah, I was really, really pleased that Chuck did that. And
cool. No, I didn't mean to jump off the
rainbow. No, that's fine.
I went off. I made a right turn there.
Now, the song Street of Dreams, now, a question that I've always been curious, like to ask any musician that was on a song that was as big as this song, when that song is laid down and the final idea, do you guys know that we got something like really special here, or are you surprised that it did like as great as it did?
You know, when you're creating... when you're creating in the studio and you're writing, you know, you treat every song as though it's the greatest thing ever. You know what I mean? And you give it the best treatment possible. And it's sometimes it's hard to know what the real standouts are until you actually done and you look back on it. But we knew that one was a really good one. And we also knew Can't Let You Go, which was the second single, was really strong. But you never know how it's going to be received by the audience. And by the fans, but they took to it right away. And of course the video helped a lot. Again, you know, early days of MTV, they were all over that Street of Dreams video. That was a big part of what broke Rainbow in, you know, wide open in the States was the Stone Cold video and the Street of Dreams video.
Now, would I be right in saying that Rainbow came to a demise because of the big Deep Purple reunion with that classic lineup? Is that what
100% that was the reason? Yeah.
If that was not to happen, would this lineup have stayed together that you were a part of?
Probably. I can tell you, I would have done another record. I had no reason to leave. Richie was very happy with the work that I'd done. I also did, you know, a bunch of orchestration. I orchestrated on Eyes of Fire for the Montreal Symphony, and then we performed Difficult to Cure, which is based on Beethoven's Ninth. Mm-hmm. We performed that with a live orchestra in Tokyo at the Budokan two nights. I did all the orchestration for that, and you know, it was a good fit. You know, Richie and I really had a real good musical thing going on. So I know I would have done another album. Probably Joe would have, very possibly it would have been the same lineup. But we'll never know.
Was there any discussions at that point? Like when, I mean, I don't know if it was talked about for a few years that Richie was like, a foregone conclusion he was going back to Deep Purple. But was there any like talk where he was like, you know, we're going to do the next album and it's going to be even more commercial or something like that? Because I actually envision, like, with the two albums that you did, I could see if there was a third album, I could see it going in more of like almost like a Foreigner, Survivor sort of the area, you know, becoming. And I think Jolin Turner's voice would have perfectly fit that. But was there ever any type of discussions like?
No, I mean, you know, like I said before, Richie likes to create in the studio, and he likes to create, you know, with a band just jamming in a living room in a big house somewhere, and then go right into studio and keep everything fresh. So even when we were planning for the Bent Out of Shape album, the plans were logistical. They were not like, well, we need to do this or that or this or that musically. You know, we just, you know, they make the plans and we all get together and you know, Richie brought in some riffs, and that's, you know, it really wasn't very premeditated in terms of like, you know, I'm going to do this on this album or that or anything like that. Okay. It just sort of happened. But in answer to your first point about Deep Purple, obviously Roger knew, but we had no idea. The rest of us, had no idea that this was going on and that the tours were happening. But I don't even think that they happened until we finished the tour. We finished the tour. The last shows were those shows with the orchestra in Budokan, and then the Japanese tour, and that's where the tour ended. And typically Richie would take, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 weeks off after a tour before we would do the next thing. So we all went home assuming that in a month or so we would get a call about what the next plan is. But instead I got a call from his manager saying, you know, Deep Purple's getting back together and Rainbow's over.
Okay. Yeah. I remember at the time there was a lot of money thrown at them to do that. I don't think anybody was really clamoring for it. I think they kind of got dragged into it because of, you know,
there
was a lot of money behind it.
Huge offer, and you know, they didn't all really get along very well.
No, that was I remember being amazed because I loved Rainbow so much. I was bummed that, you know, it was over, and yeah. I grew up on Purple from the 70s, and I was shocked they got back together because there was a lot of bad blood. But they did put out one tremendous record from that reunion.
Perfect Strangers album was the first one, I believe. Yeah. That was great. And you know, it's a funny story. That song, Perfect Strangers, that riff, we jammed on that.
Oh, really?
For the Bent Out of Shape album.
Interesting. And,
he had that riff back then.
Wow.
But it didn't materialize into anything. And then when I heard that on the record came out, I was like, hey, wait a minute, I know that riff.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what was the next bit? Was Hammerhead the next band you transitioned to after?
Well, I wasn't really a member of Hammerhead. I just produced it. Actually I did a world tour with Little Steven first.
Okay.
After Rainbow, Little Steven and the Disciples of Soul, his Voice of America tour. I did that. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of that is when I got the offer to produce this band Hammerhead. And, you know, they didn't have a keyboard player. So I ended up playing keyboards on the tracks that needed it. Not all the tracks had keyboards, but in fact, the song Early Warning has one of my favorite solos I've ever done on any record ever is on the song Early Warning, is a Minnie Moog solo.
Yeah. It's really a great song. Yeah.
But anyway, and their drummer, you know, I agreed to produce the record. I wasn't really, I thought they were great and I really liked the songs, but I didn't think the drummer was up to snuff. And I said, I'll do this, but I want to bring in, you know, a top drummer.
Joe Franco.
I brought in Joe Franco. Yeah. Cause I was a big Good Rats fan.
Me too. Joe Franco is a beast.
Yeah. He's awesome. Yeah. And, I didn't really know him. I had met him somehow, but I was able to get to him and I said, hey, I got this thing. And he loved it because I would refer to, you know, the song that you did on this Good Rat song and this song, and then you played this fill, something like that. And he just ate it up. And he was the perfect drummer for that album. He played his ass off. It was great.
He was in a band with Dee Snider called Widowmaker.
Yes. And I remember
his drumming on that album is like from another world. Like he's
exactly
tremendous. Yeah.
He's really, really good and a great guy. We've been friends ever since. And sadly, that record never really saw the light of day. And the band got dropped before it was released. We finished the record, but it never got released. And then it was the release copy that you showed me earlier that you have there. That was put out, I think,
about 20 years ago, right?
Yeah, early 2000s. Yeah. And the guys got it, because Ian Parry has done really well too, singing in a lot of different bands.
Ian Parry really made his way in the power metal, the Euro. Yeah. He was in a band called Elegy for quite a while.
Yes, yes.
That was a really...
They're great, yeah.
Oh, tremendous power metal band.
Yeah, and he's an awesome singer. And so I think through some of that had come about, there all of a sudden there was this interest in putting this album out that never saw the light of day. And we couldn't, you know, we got permission to do it from EMI, that Electrola that had signed them originally, which was great, but nobody could find the masters. But I had a safety copy.
Okay.
Yeah. I had a safety half inch master, and we made the CD from that.
Okay. Wow. I thought you were an actual member of the band, because the band, they have a band picture and you're in it. It looks like, you know, like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was the producer, and you know, they didn't really have a keyboard player at all.
Okay.
But and listening to the songs, I was like, guys, this would be cool. This would really work on this song, and not all of them, but on some of those songs. And I was very much part of, I was kind of like in the band, figuratively, not literally, while we were making the record, you know, and you know, I spoke to them as a fellow band member, even though I was the producer. And so when they wanted to do the picture for the album cover, they said, we want you in. And I was like, okay, cool.
Yeah. Okay. I'm of the thought process, and Mark could vouch for this, any band could always use keyboards. I'm a keyboard nut.
Yeah.
And when people ask my opinion sometimes on bands without keyboards, the first thing I always say would be better with keyboards.
Yeah.
Get a keyboard player.
Yeah.
It just adds so much to, the sound.
There are some great bands that didn't have keyboards. I'm a big Rush fan. And before Geddy Lee started doing keyboards in the early years, I mean, that's just great, great power rock. Yeah. The Good Rats, one of my favorite bands of all time, didn't have keyboards except on a couple of tracks here and there. And a lot of great bands. But having said that, I think the stereotype is that keyboards tend to, or sometimes keyboards, people think that it's going to lighten up the sound. But that's, to me, depends on the keyboard player.
Exactly.
I'm not looking to lighten the sound. I'm looking to make it tougher and sound bigger. And the keyboard parts, when they're constructed properly and when the sounds are right, can really enhance the guitars and make the guitars sound bigger and more powerful. And that was always my approach to keyboards in a hard rock band. It's kind of a supportive role that they're playing. And, and the same, even if you listen to Deep Purple, I mean, a big part of the Deep Purple sound was John.
Perfect example.
And if you took that away, Richie's playing was great, but he didn't have this big, giant, fat sound, the big, giant, fat sound that
was the keyboards
were known for. Well, it was the combination of the two, really. It was the combination of the way their parts integrated in the two, and Richie's sound worked with John Lord's sound, and that was the sound of Deep Purple, I was inspired by that, of course, as a young musician, and not that I wanted to copy what John Lord did, but I the way that it worked with Richie's playing was certainly a role model for me of how I approach not just keyboards with Richie, but keyboards in general. I mean,
well, he was the epitome of aggressive keyboard playing, John.
Exactly.
He beat the shit out of the Hammond, and he just, you watched it and he was just like you just couldn't take your eyes off of him. I remember seeing him as a kid for the first time.
Right.
Made a huge impression on me to see
him.
And
Keith Emerson.
Keith Emerson, the other one. Rick Wakeman. Yeah. These guys did not play bashful keyboards. And
well put. Yeah. And that's the school that I come from.
I grew up.
Yeah, I'm an aggressive player, and I was influenced. Also, Ken Hensley from Uriah Heep. I was a big Uriah Heep fan.
I get it. Yeah.
And a lot of my organ playing is like a kind of a combination of Ken Hensley, Keith Emerson, and John Lord. Like if you were able to roll them into a ball or something. Mm. With a little bit of my own flair on it, it's those were my big inspirations for that overdriven B3 sound that I just love.
Mm. I was a huge Hensley fan too. I mean, I think Demons and Wizards is as good amazing as album. Any Purple, Zeppelin, Sabbath totally. Album ever done.
Totally agree. Yeah.
Nice. So, well, talking about keyboard bands, let's segue into the band Red Dawn, which was your band that you put together. But kind of as a precursor to that, there was Infinity, which was an album that came out a number of years back. But I know that was like kind of the start of Red Dawn. If you could talk a little bit about that, the Infinity album, I know Mitch Malloy was involved with that. So talk about that and then kind of go into the Red Dawn thing.
So, you know, I always wanted to have my own band. And, after Rainbow, I was busy right away with Little Steven and then the Hammerhead thing. But then I had, you know, a gap and I was like, you know, I had some songs and I started to put together a band. I actually had a band at the time. And I met Mitch Malloy, who's an amazing singer. And he and I started writing together. Nobody knew who he was at the time yet. But we wrote some great songs, and what later became the Infinity album was the demos that we were making, trying to get a record deal. And, so then I did the Cyndi Lauper tour, and then I came back and worked on it some more. And then I did the Robert Palmer tour and I came back and worked on it some more. But all the time we were not able to get a record deal. Not for any rhyme or reason. I thought the songs were really strong and Mitch was a great singer, but it just never happened. And we never got signed. Until this Japanese band, I'm sorry, Japanese label, EMI Toshiba, and this is maybe 1990 or something, around 90 or 91, and they signed me, but I said, because they had heard the demos, and they were like, well, this is fantastic, we want to sign you, and I said, I don't have a band anymore, everybody's all gone off and done their own thing, and they said, well, you'll put together a new band, right? And I said, okay, and that was it. So I signed to EMI, and then I went. I set out to find the best musicians I could find at that time to play a lot of those Infinity songs, but also to write some new ones. So I was auditioning, and I had worked with Tristan Avakian on doing. Funny enough, we had met each other doing karaoke music and not singing in a bar, but we were actually recording the tracks for it. And, he was great at copying guitar players and copying sounds. And I was really good at the keyboards and stuff like that. And there was this company in New York that was just, it was the early days of karaoke. It was becoming very popular, and they just needed content. And I was on this team of people that we were just recording cover songs constantly and just copying this. And I saw him playing, and I was like, this guy's really good. And then my deal happened, and I asked him if he would want to come down and audition, and he did, and he's just a blow away guitar player.
He's a great player. I'm actually going to see him in a couple months with the Mark Martel and the One Vision Queen. Oh my God,
him playing Brian May, forget it. Yeah. You know, he manages to, he plays it absolutely perfectly and manages to throw shapes while he's doing it. What a great guitar player. And he really shone on the Red Dawn album.
Oh yeah.
And then I was looking for a singer. Mitch was off doing his own stuff at that point, and I needed to find the right singer. Somehow I got connected to Larry Baud, and I heard one of his demos, and I was just blown away. I was like, this is the voice. He's Joe Lynn Turner, but with grit, but he's got that power. Mm-hmm. And this is totally the voice I want. But he didn't really want to do it, not because he was – Larry's is old. He's probably about maybe 10, 12 years older than me. And he had been, in this a whole bunch of cover bands, and he was kind of getting – he was just kind of burnt on it and just like really ready to kind of give up. And, he had a day job already doing, as a woodshop teacher, and he still played in cover bands at night. But he was like, well, he goes, I like the stuff, but I don't know. And then I was like – it took me several visits to talk him in. He's like, all right, I'll give this one more shot. And I said, all right, cool. Amazing singer. We wrote some of the strongest songs on that album, Dangerous Child, Flying High, who were written with Larry and Tristan. And then just what Larry and Tristan brought to the table of the old songs. And then of course, Chuck and Greg playing, and all of those Infinity songs, they just totally came to life in a way that was fantastic. So that's how that album happened. But sadly, the album was released. It was very widely praised worldwide. Mm. Critically acclaimed all over the world. But it came at right when the grunge thing started, and it's bad timing. Had I put that record out 5 years earlier,
absolutely, it would have been really big. You picked the single worst year, 93. was
93 to 95.
You couldn't get a worse gig.
Very true. And so it's really a shame the way it went, but that's, you know, that's the way it goes. You know, we did one little tour. Larry and I did an acoustic promo, radio promo tour in Japan, but we never got to play live or tour as a band, sadly.
I've seen that clip on YouTube.
Yeah, I was going to say there was I don't know if it's still there. There was a clip on that on YouTube.
Yeah, yeah. That was from Larry and I we were doing I'll Be There from the album. And it was just piano and acoustic guitar and him singing. And we did a bunch of TV shows and a bunch of radio things. And it went great. Just bad timing.
He was involved in a lot of different projects that were good, but just never, like, he was in a band called USA.
Yes.
And he was in Network too, wasn't he?
Network.
Yeah.
That was
a terrific record too. And they,
It's
just stuff that forever, whatever reason, didn't take off.
Right. Hmm. Right. Yeah. I'm very proud of that record. I wished it had sold more copies, but it's still, you know, really, really revered worldwide. I run into people all over the world, even in territories where it was never released. Mm. And people just, you know, people who like that style of music really love that album.
Yeah. Well, you got two more guys right here saying the same thing.
Right.
It's like the epitome of an underground classic, that album.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's still revered and talked about, and you know it's always like people compare it. You know, bands that come out like that, mm-hmm. it's always used as a benchmark of, you know. And you're right. It's, you know, if that album would have came out 4 or 5 years earlier, you would definitely got a major deal on it. That's for sure.
Yeah, no question. Yeah. And everybody looked good. We put, you know, we sounded great. We practiced.
No, it had the whole shebang. It wasn't lacking in every. It even had a great cover too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Dan Muro did a great job with that.
And a lot of people don't really think how important a cover is with hard rock music, but it really is. And
right.
It's like the cherry on the cake for album.
Yeah. And the logo, it's all part of it. Mm. The whole,
yes.
Whole thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that was 1993. You know, we say the timing was off, but right around the corner, you joined up with Billy Joel, right?
I think the album was originally released in 92.
Wasn't that 92? Right. Yes.
Mm-hmm. To the best of my memory, 93 is when I joined Billy.
Okay.
But it was summer of 93, July, I joined Billy. But the reason that I started looking for a gig was because the Red Dawn thing didn't happen. Mm. And the record didn't sell. And, you know, I put a lot of my own money into that production. And, you know, I needed a gig at that point. You know, I had to make the decision. Do I want to continue pounding the pavement with Red Dawn and be a starving musician and go deliver pizzas or something to stay alive? Or do I go out and look for another gig? And much as it was my dream to always have my own band, as almost any musician would have, I had to make that difficult decision that, you know, I'd rather work as a musician than starve as a musician and go work a day job somewhere. So you know, I started looking for a gig, and that's how the Billy Joel thing happened.
Well, how did you find that? How did that come about?
Well, I mean, I was starting to put feelers out that I was looking for something. And of course, at this point in my career, you know, especially because of, you know, Whitesnake and Steve Vai and all these other projects that I'd done, you know, a lot of session work and of course the big tours and everything, my name would pop up in the circles now when someone like Billy Joel was looking for a keyboard player. So my name popped up, and this was a closed audition. It was only two people invited to audition, me and one other guy.
Wow.
And, I beat him out and I got the gig.
And here you are 32 years later.
Well,
right?
Who could ever in a million years dream of that? I mean, I basically signed up for the River of Dreams tour, is what it was. But yeah, I guess, yeah, 32 years later, it's kind of worked out pretty well.
I guess you'd have to look at it. Even if Red Dawn did really well, you weren't getting 32 years out of Red Dawn. So.
Fair point. Fair
point. You would have got the two albums, and then the label dropped you.
Right. You're probably
that everybody,
right.
That everybody Sadly. Did.
Same as everybody, right?
Yeah, you're probably right. So, yeah, look, everything happens the way it happens. And I'm very proud of that record, the Red Dawn record. And, you know, I wouldn't change one note on it if I went back to redo it. And that's why, you know, I've had offers sometimes where people are like, well, can't you like remix a track? I was like, what's wrong with it the way it is?
I hate the remix thing. I really wish people would stop doing that.
Yeah. And then they wanted bonus tracks to release it. And I don't really, you know, really have anything. I mean, there was one song that we recorded half of it. We recorded the basic tracks for the song Promise of Love, which is on the Infinity album. And that would have been the 11th track. But for budgetary reasons, after we had done all the basic tracks for everything, for budgetary reasons, I had to pick the best 10, and that one got pushed aside. Not because I didn't think it was any weaker. I had to pick one, and something had to go, because I really only had the money to finish 10 of them. Yeah. So, and then I didn't turn out not to even have the money to do that, and that's why I ended up having to put my own money in. So.
Okay.
Wow. So, let's talk a little bit about Billy Joel. I want to kind of talk about, obviously, the iconic residency of Madison Square Garden, sure. Something that started in, was it 2014, ran to 2024, a 10-year period, monthly gigs, with the exception of COVID, of course, where there was a little bit of downtime. What is that like? And can you just describe what it's like to just every month play Madison Square Garden?
It's all kind of surreal, to be honest. Madison Square Garden has this energy, which I experienced. Of course, I used to go to concerts as a kid in Madison Square Garden. So that place has even a more iconic meaning to me personally, because, you know, I saw Pink Floyd there. I saw Aerosmith. I saw Led Zeppelin. And, you know, as a young kid, it was one of the only places that my parents let me go to concerts at, because they could put me on the train. I would take the train in, go upstairs to the concert, and come down and get on the train and just go right back home. Yeah. So it was deemed relatively safe, and I was allowed to go to concerts there. So and the Edgar Winter Group I saw there.
So did
Did you really?
And I saw Edgar and Johnny together in 75 at the Garden.
I think that might have been when it was.
Yeah.
Because that was actually my very first concert that I ever went to, was Edgar Winter Group at Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
Wow.
And my second one was Uriah Heep in Philadelphia. Wow. But
Did you go to Pink Floyd the Animals tour?
I was totally there.
I was there too.
Really? Wait, were you sitting three rows?
And I saw Zeppelin in 77, the third.
That's what I saw the there too. Show. And Frampton, I saw there too. But I also saw Pink Floyd on the Wall tour at Nassau Coliseum, because I was such a big Pink Floyd fan.
Me too.
And I was at Berkeley at the time, and I saw that they're going to do the Wall, and they were only doing it in London, New York, and L.A. And I was like, I have to go to this. And I you know, took the train down, and I left Boston and went to New York just to see that. And I'm so glad I did, because it was such a legendary thing. And of course, seeing it again then, you know, about 10 years ago when it was doing, it was really cool. Wow. Anyway, getting back to your question. So, so Madison Square Garden has this really iconic place in my mind personally. And I play there also with Cyndi Lauper. You know, I also played there a bunch of times prior to that with Billy, but in fact, we had the previous record, which was 12 consecutive sellouts, which became the 12 Gardens Live album. And you know, that was an amazing accomplishment, let alone 104 consecutive sellouts.
Yeah.
You know, Billy, you know, we started this thinking that nobody knew if this was going to work or not. No one's ever done anything like that before. All the typical residencies are in Las Vegas, which Billy didn't want to do. They offered him one in Atlantic City, but he didn't want to do that. Then the idea came about to do this like once a month. And we thought maybe it would last 2-3 years, maybe, if it was a big success. No one even thought 4-10. Wow. Nobody thought that would happen. So Billy's idea was to do this as long as the demand was there, we'd just keep doing it. But after 10 years, the demand it was still there. It just didn't go away.
Yeah.
So then his thinking became, well, rather than wait for it to peter out, let's go out on top. And he just picked this milestone show, which was his 150th lifetime sellout, of which, you know, I had done 130 of those with him. And he said, let's just end it there. We could have kept going, but he wanted to put an end to it. But now that we don't have that every month, now we're doing all stadiums, and we're doing that, you know, this summer we're playing Yankee Stadium, Citi Field, and MetLife, which we've been able to do during the Garden run.
Yeah. It gives you that more, your freedom, because you couldn't play anywhere in a certain radius, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah, yeah. It secures that opportunity. How is Billy doing? I know he just had a fall and he's going through some physical therapy.
Yeah, he's good. He's doing great. He just needs some downtime. And he's going to be fine. And, you know, he really hadn't taken a break since we started in 2014, obviously, except for COVID. He's doing great. He just needs some downtime and he's going to be fine. We're all really looking forward to starting up again in July. Pittsburgh will be our first show back. And then right after that, Yankee Stadium.
Great. Okay. Glad to hear that. That's good. I wanted to ask you, because you're not only the keyboard player in the band for 30 some odd years, but you're the musical director now. Tell everybody, what is a musical director and what do you do in that capacity? Sure.
So the musical director is in a rock band is kind of the band leader. Obviously, it's Billy's band, but you know, I run the rehearsals, I run the sound checks. If he wants to add a new song into the show, it's one phone call for him, and then I make sure everybody learns the parts they need to do. I write charts for the horn players if they need it, and I just kind of keep the train on the tracks. We're blessed with an incredibly talented band, and so a lot of times my job is just kind of to keep it all together, but I also make sure everybody's playing all the right parts and, you know, that type of thing. So I run the band, when Billy's not there. And then even a lot of times when he is there, he's like, Dave, what do we need to go over? What do you think? And, and then that's kind of what my job is, as musical director.
Okay. It's funny because you talked about the 10 years worth of shows. I mean, there was a lot of special guests that would pop up here and there, right?
Well, that
I mean,
was a big part of my job too. Yes.
Yeah. So you got involved with that too.
Exactly. Yeah. And cause when these people come up, these guest artists, we have to learn the songs. I have to make sure everybody knows what's going on. And, although some of them happened very spontaneously, almost last minute. But yeah, that was a big part of my job as well, and then a lot of times to interface with that artist, with the guest artist, musical director, or sometimes with the artist themselves, make sure they have, you know, what they needed, and make sure that they were going to feel comfortable with the way that we were going to play the song, find out what version, you know, are you still doing it in the key of the record? You know, some people drop the keys sometimes. What ending do you want us to learn? Those types of things. Because then on the day of the show, Billy hates rehearsals. So, you know, we do a sound check with them, but we'll run the song a couple of times, but pretty much that's it. So, you know, my job there is to make sure that the artist is going to be happy with the way we're playing the song and make sure that the band learns it the way the artist wants us to do it.
Mm. Okay. Was there something you wanted to add in before?
No, I think I covered everything.
I have a little small list here of some things that I was looking over your bio. Sure. And maybe you could give us just kind of like one of these sort of things where I'll throw something out at you, give me your thoughts on it. But I'll start with the band and the release. 1998, there was a band came out, was Departure. Mm-hmm. Mike Walsh was it was his band. And I know you had history with Mike, Jersey sure. guy. I think it was in one of your first high school bands, right? Crystal Visions, was it?
That is correct. Yeah. Mike and I played in a band in high school, Crystal Visions. We started Crystal Visions, I think maybe eighth or ninth grade, something like that. And then, it continued into high school for a bit. And, Mike's a real talented guy. And, he was putting this thing together over the years. I kind of lost touch with him for a while, and then we got back in touch, and I played on some of his demos. We did a few things together, and then he got this record deal for Departure, and he asked me if I would guest on it. I said sure, you know. And I, in fact, I did something for one of his recent releases again, maybe a year or two ago.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if it's come out yet. I think it did come out. I don't recall the name of it, but yeah, he came here to my studio and we did some stuff here.
Oh wow.
Maybe 2-3 years ago.
Okay. Another one I'm going to throw at you, Dream Theater.
Okay.
obviously a very iconic progressive metal band. Yeah. I know you played a little bit or did some programming of some sorts on the A Change of Seasons EP.
Yes.
But I think that was a band you have a little more involvement in, that you were kind of asked to join the band?
I was asked to join the band. Yeah. After Kevin Moore left and they were looking for a new keyboard player, and they asked me to join the band. And I was on the road with Billy at the time on the River of Dreams tour. So I wasn't available. I would have loved to have done it. I, you know, I've certainly done a record with them, joining the band. Who knows? You know, I like their music, and you know, the musicianship is right up my alley of what they do. But I wasn't available, and I had to, you know, turn it down. So they ended up getting Derek Sherinian, who was very young at the time, and at the time was a very good player, but didn't really know his way around his gear yet. So they asked me, would I come in and do programming, you know, program the synths to get the sounds for him. And so I said, sure. And so I did that. And I'm friends with all those guys. And I'm also good friends with Jordan Rudess, who is the keyboard player that and he's a great fit.
Oh,
in that
great.
Band.
Yeah.
And so look, everything works out the way it should. And I'm happy for Jordan. He's made a great career out of that. And he's really the right keyboard player for that band. It's worked out great. And I'm content with the way my career path went too. So
sure. I mean, you could have played Radio City with Dream Theater recently, or you could play, MetLife or Yankee Stadium or Citi Field with Billy. So I think things worked out all right.
Yeah. But no disrespect to those guys. Of course, they're great musicians, and I'm friends with John Petrucci and Mike Portnoy as well. And, so I know those guys, and they're great, good guys and fantastic musicians, all of them.
Yeah. Another one I'm going to throw at you, and this one might be a little out of left field. Mark Thompson Smith had an album, a British guy, right? Comes to the Jersey area here. He puts out an album called A Far Cry from New Jersey. What was your involvement with that?
I produced it, and I played on several of the tracks. That was actually through Mike Walsh. Mike Walsh had met, I don't know how he met Mark Thompson Smith, but he somehow ran into him somewhere and brought him to New Jersey to sing. I think maybe they were going to put a band together, but maybe they decided it would just be called Mark Thompson Smith. I don't know the exact history of how that happened, but Mike called me and said, hey, I got this fantastic singer from England. You know, would you be interested in producing it? And I listened to his voice. He's a great singer. And so I said, sure. And so Mike and I worked actually together on that. And I played on a few of the tracks, not really as a band member, just filling in with the keyboards that it needed. And I produced that album. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He was in a British band, Praying Mantis, for a short period of time.
Yeah. Was that after? I think it was after that, wasn't it?
It was probably after it. Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. But yeah, real great singer, talented guy. Yeah.
Nice. Well, another one I'm going to ask, and you brought it up before, you mentioned it a little bit. You did play with Steve Vai on one or a few of the albums, actually. But talk about your involvement in Whitesnake and the Slip of the Tongue album and how that kind of transpired.
Well, I Steve Vai and I played in a band together at Berkeley. And we were 18 and we had a band together up there before he was in Zappa and before anything happened for either of us. I know him a long, 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 long time. And in fact, I introduced him to his wife who was at Berkeley and I actually introduced him to each other. They're still married to this day, with two kids, two sons. I'm in touch with them, fairly regularly still. He's a good friend, but no, Steve wanted me to play on the Passion and Warfare album. And, so I went out to LA, and I was working on that album, and he was kind of doing that at the same time as the Slip of the Tongue album, which didn't have a name yet. But he was doing the Whitesnake album kind of at the same time. And I finished playing on a bunch of tracks for Passion and Warfare, which also hadn't been named yet. And Steve just said, hey, you know what, while you're here, we could use some keyboards on this Whitesnake stuff. What do you think? I said, sure. So he switched reels of tape. I mean, it was literally, he took those days of 2-inch tape, took his masters off the machine, put the Whitesnake masters on, and just like that, right place at the right time, I played on a Whitesnake album.
Wow. That's cool. The last one I'm going to throw at you is, and we were just talking about this prior to starting the recording, released by a band named Climb. Mm-hmm. Now, Warren Cromartie, ex-baseball player, Major League Baseball player, was his band. But talk about your involvement in that album. It was an album from 1988, I think it was. Take a Chance was the title of that. Talk about that and how you got involved in that whole thing. I know he has a history with Rush, right? Warren does.
Well, yeah, he's I believe he's Canadian. But he was friendly with the guys in Rush. He was a drummer, and always loved drums, but made it as a baseball player just the way, you know, and not as a drummer. It's just the way his life went. And I met him because I was a huge baseball fan. And really?
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah. I'm actually a baseball junkie. I mean,
I am too.
Really?
Baseball and music. I'm totally obsessed with since a child. And I'm 66 years old, and there's never been a bump in the road.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, it's fascinating.
You're looking at some music pictures behind us here, but I'm staring at a wall straight across from here. It's got Mets guys all over the place, Pete Rose there. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Well, for some reason, you know, baseball players and musicians seem to have this mutual admiration society.
Yes.
Warren was playing at the time for the Yomiuri Giants, or maybe he was playing. I don't remember. He was in Japan,
He had one of the first players to go over there.
Yeah.
And that's where I met him, and he came backstage at a Rainbow show, and I remember him sitting down, and Chuck Berge had always played it on a drum pad. He would warm up on a drum pad in the dressing room, and Warren grabbed a pair of sticks and started, you know, playing and stuff, and then. So that's how I originally met him. And then I think after that, he was finished with his Japan stint, he came and played for the Expos, I think, for a while.
Yes.
And then I saw him play once or twice with the Expos, and we just kind of kept in touch. But then when his baseball career ended, he said, you know, it's been my dream to make an album. And now that my baseball career is ending, you know, I would love to make an album. And he was living in Florida, and I happened to be down there doing a whole bunch of R&B records in the late 80s. I was doing a lot of synth programming and playing on this one producer that I worked with, Lou Pace. And I did like five albums with him. We just kept with the same group of guys, and we just kept changing singers. And Stacey Ladislaw came out of that, an artist named Nicole, Donna Allen, all these records I did, it was all like the same batch of people. Mm-hmm. We just kept changing singers. Anyway, so I was down there for quite a while. And then when Warren Cromartie found out that I was down there, he said, hey, you know, I live in Miami and I have a studio in the house across the street from me. Why don't you come over and, you know, on one of your breaks and let's do some tracks. And I said, sure. So I went over and I didn't know that. I think he eventually got a deal in Japan because he's so famous in Japan. And that's how that album happened. And he just put together some session players and we made that album right there in this studio at the house across the street from him.
And, you know, I never made that connection. Now it makes sense because I always wondered why that album only came out in Japan and how he managed to get a Japanese deal. But he played baseball in Japan.
Of course. Yeah. No, he was huge baseball player in Japan.
He was a big star over there.
Big star. Yeah. So when the record company is like, wow, you can play, you want to put an album out?
Right.
Sure.
Yeah. Done deal. Yeah,
it was a done deal. Yeah.
He was a pretty good player for the Expos, too.
He was. Yeah. I think he played right field.
Yeah, I think he initially came up in left field, and then when they traded Ellis Valentine, they moved him to right, and Tim Raines played left, if my memory is correct.
I think you're right. I do remember Tim Raines playing left field for them, too.
Yeah.
He was on the team. Yeah, so, yeah. Wow, good trivia.
Interesting stuff.
We'll have another podcast. We'll just talk baseball, for an hour and 10 minutes.
I'm in. And it's funny because I have a lot of musical connections too, because I played the national anthem at several times. I played the national anthem at Yankee Stadium, and I also played it twice at Dodger Stadium and once at Fenway Park.
Really? Okay. That's really cool. Wow.
Yeah. It's on my website or you can just YouTube David Rosenthal National Anthem Yankee Stadium. It comes right up.
Wow.
That was really fun.
Nice. Anything else you wanted to?
I actually wanted to start a baseball podcast in addition to this. And his hands are full. I don't want to give him too much.
Here's another one for you. I actually threw out the first pitch at Fenway Park once too.
Really?
Yeah. It's a funny story because, you know, Billy was, we sold out Fenway Park seven times, which no other artist had done.
Wow.
And they wanted to give Billy an award. And he didn't feel like going up to Boston. He said, Dave, will you go up and just accept this award? And I said, sure. So and then they said, well, since you're going to be here anyway, would you want to throw out the first pitch? And I was like, yeah, you know, at Fenway Park. I mean, okay, I'm a Yankee fan, but Fenway Park is legendary. And so I said, of course, sure. I practiced that throwing out that first pitch, I practiced that more than any gig I've ever practiced for.
Yeah, I would too.
Yeah, because I didn't want to be the guy.
You want to be that guy that throws it 10 feet over the catcher's head.
I did
or
not,
bounces it 20 YouTube, times to him. Yeah.
YouTube forever, the rest of your life. I will not be that guy. So I really practiced my ass off, you know, just constantly throwing pitches and, you know, and everything. And I went up there and I threw it right over the plate. I didn't throw it really hard. It wasn't a fastball, but it went right over the plate. And I can say nobody scored while I was pitching.
Just there you go.
Who was the catcher?
Nice.
There's a video online. I don't remember his name. I'm sorry.
What year was it?
2017, maybe?
Or okay. 16, pretty current.
Anyway, there's a video on my website, and it's also on YouTube of me throwing out the first pitch.
Okay, that's really cool.
To check it out. So as far as socials go, is it just davidrosenthal.com that people can keep up to date with you?
And on Instagram, at David Rosenthal Musician.
Okay.
I'm on Instagram as well. I don't do Facebook or any of that stuff. I just do those things, and I keep it purely professional. I don't post pictures of my dinner or any of that stuff, you know?
Well, David, thank you so much. And before we go, I do have to do a special shout out to David Palamini, who hooked us up with this interview. We appreciate that. We had him on our podcast at the end of last year, and he brought your name up, and here we are a few months later, and we made it happen. So thank you to David. But thank you, David, for talking to us today. Really good stories, good stuff. Appreciate it. And best of luck to you. Looking forward to the three area shows with Billy Joel later this year in the New York, New Jersey area. Like you said, MetLife Stadium in New Jersey with Stevie Nicks on the bill. Citi Field with Sting, I believe. And Yankee Stadium with Rod Stewart.
That is correct. Yep. Okay. Yep. I'm looking forward to those too. And thank you very much for having me. This was a fun chat.
I cool. I'm glad.
Thanks, David.
Appreciate it. Thanks. Have a great day. Thank you.
Take care, brother.
All right. Bye.